road trip.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. It's good to see you all in a slightly more cozy room at a meeting when I don't think we'll be going as long today. I'm going to open up an informational meeting on an introduction to bonding, and I thought this was an important topic for us to get a little introduction to, given some of the discussion we had when we were last together and some of the discussion that's going to come before the committee on how bonding works, what the various choices are for us as a legislature. And we're fortunate to have Laura Lockwood McCall here from the Treasurer's Office. If you would like to come forward, please. I'm not sure if Mr. Salvaggio is joining you. He's on the agenda as well, but happy to have you get us started. And I understand you have somewhere to be later on, so we'll do our best to make efficient use of your time.
For the record, my name is Laura Lockwood McCall. I'm the Director of the Debt Management Division within the Oregon State Treasury. Some of you know me from different years in the legislative session, but I've been the debt manager overseeing all of our issuances at the state since 2004. So I've been here during the credit rating upgrades, not the downgrades. So I'd like to keep it that way. When asked to present sort of bonding 101, I don't think you have the time or really want to know the details, but what I do have is a brief presentation for you of some of the bigger pictures. Is this on?
Yes.
No. Is it on now?
Yep. No,
sorry. That are findings from our annual state debt capacity advisory report. I was told by my staff who helps put this together that you all receive one of these in your inbox about February 1st. So go look for it along with everything else. It's an annual compendium of information about all the state debt. We try and break it up into some of the chapters and some of the concepts that you'll be seeing today. And we're always more than happy to, anybody wants to talk about debt, know that that's what we do. So without further ado, I'm going to share with you some of the findings of the Debt Capacity Commission this year.
And just as you get started, let me ask, are you okay with us interrupting your questions?
If
you
want to get to questions. Perfect. As long okay. as, you know. Sometimes it's okay for me to say, I'll get to that, then we'll just,
yes, of course,
we'll do it that way.
Great.
I have about 20, 25 slides.
Great.
So the first thing is, what is the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission? For those who don't know, it's been in our state law since somewhere around 1998, and it's a group that meets annually and looks at various issues in debt. It's getting dark in here. We measure all of the state debt, and it gives us a framework to help the legislature and the governor's office determine what the overall bonding levels should be that are both prudent at the same time that also accomplish the goal of economic development, education, and some of the other things that state government's responsible for. And most recently, we've started highlighting some issues that we think are of concern in terms of emerging issues in debt management. You can see below on this chart the current members. There's State Treasurer Ted Wheeler is our chair under state law, and we have one member from both the House and the Senate, and you can see the current membership. And then we have a public member, as well as the director of DAS. And so the current public member is Tim Dewey. Some of you know, is an economist at the University of Oregon. So let's talk very briefly about debt capacity concepts. And this is a hard thing to get your mind around, but general obligation bonds, in our state constitution, you're not allowed for us to sell any more than $50,000 in state general obligation bonds without a special carve-out. So there's very strict limitations on general obligation debt. So you may have heard of people talk about Article F or G on 11F, and what that is an Article 11 are all the carve-outs. They're all voter-approved. There's debt limits on all of these different types of bonds. And we just sort of throw the terms around, but if you were to actually go and, again, in our report, we kind of list all the different constitutional amendments. Some of the bonds haven't ever been sold. BPA, for example, back in the 30s, the citizenry approved our ability to sell bonds for transmission lines. And then BPA showed up, and we never did it. Some of those
for very specific purposes.
It's always got to be for a specific purpose. So there's a higher ed one. There's a transmission line one. There's one for forest restoration that was approved after the Tillamook burn. So, again, there's specific carve-outs under law. Now, some of those bonds, that when we do sell general obligation bonds, are actually general fund supported. and we'll be talking about those in a minute. But there's many other types of general obligation bonds that are self-supporting. So in our debt capacity study, not only do we look at debt limits, sort of constitutional, but we say on a practical basis, let's look at the ones that are general fund supported, because the self-supporting ones, we just want to make sure that the revenue streams that are there are good and strong and have good coverage so that the general fund never has to come out of pocket. At the end of the day, the general fund is pledging. So you've, through statute, pretty much assigned myself and folks in the state agencies and DAS to always make sure that's the case. And we'll talk about some of those kind of bond programs in a minute. Now, a direct revenue bond is not part of the GO pledge. It's not the full faith and credit of the entire state. Rather, we pick specific revenue streams, and the sole pledge for repayment is that revenue stream. A good example would be ODOT. They have a highway user tax and revenue bond program, and so the various monies that come into ODOT from fees, from licensing, weight mile, and gas taxes are all pledged to pay off the bonds for ODOT's revenue bonds. The state's general fund is not a credit risk, and they actually have a higher credit rating at their senior lien than the state, because we have three times coverage, which means we have three times as much revenue as annual debt service. So you'll hear me talk about coverage a lot. That's very important when we look at credit quality. We have appropriation bonds, and by that, these are the bonds that are not part of the Constitution carve-out. They're not the full faith and credit, but nevertheless, there's a way that we promise to repay every year. We used to use them through issuance of certificates of participation, often for things like prisons and mental hospitals that probably would have been very tough long ago to convince voters to approve, but nevertheless are facilities that just cost too much to pay for on a pay-as-you-go basis. We needed some sort of a financing mechanism. And so COPs were created. It's a lease financing tool. It's debt by any other name, but legally and constitutionally, it's not general obligation bonds. Those appropriation deficit bonds were also used in 2003 to balance the state budget towards the end of the session. Again, they weren't GO bonds. They were just, we promised to pay. And the COPs and appropriation credit bonds do not get the same credit ratings because they're not of the same quality of security pledge. So it's usually at least one notch below our state credit rating. And lastly, we have conduit revenue bonds. Several different state agencies are authorized to basically sell bonds where the borrower pays back the debt service. The state's not on the hook, but we're just really a tool to allow the placement of tax exemption, the federal tax exemption on interest. So we have three programs, one in multifamily housing, one for small businesses through OBDD, and then we have the Oregon Facilities Authority that helps facilitate nonprofit financing. So I'll stop and say if there's any questions. But I think it's important to kind of keep those in your mind as we go forward, the big picture chunks, different types of bonds.
That's very helpful. Any questions? Representative Nathanson.
It's sort of a comment and a question. Because you mentioned housing, I became aware a few weeks ago through a discussion with the Director of Housing and Community Services that there are, I think, 14 different agencies agencies or commissions involved in helping fund housing or affordable housing for Oregonians. To what extent is the Treasurer's Office involved in helping coordinate or advise all this activity that's going on, not only through your own agency?
Through the chair, Representative Nathanson, we are the issuing agent for bonds that are sold at Oregon Housing Community Services. They have a variety of different revenue bond programs. One is first-time homebuyer indenture, and there's a couple of those. We do multifamily housing that's both HUD guaranteed as well as standalone conduits. So that's our sort of like on a day-to-day basis, we do that with them. We work with them. But independently, there's a number of housing authorities around the state that also sell bonds. We don't have a direct role with them, but in order for any housing group to sell bonds, they have to get a private activity bond allocation because any housing is considered private activity under the federal tax code. So I chair a committee on behalf of the treasurer where we allocate that PAB cap, which is actually built into the bond bill, that we have that authority. So we generally see those projects when they come for a PAB allocation. We've done a number of them with the Portland Housing Authority, which is, I think, now called Home Forward. We've done them with PDC. Recently, we saw our first one with Clackamas County's Housing Authority, and I know Salem Housing Authority is coming. Other than that, our office doesn't have any reason to participate with the local housing authority in bonding. I should add that occasionally there'll be a nonprofit housing group that will come through the Oregon Facilities Authority, but we have been trying to encourage them to go through Oregon Housing rather than through Oregon Facilities Authority.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lively.
Well, I have the back to the condo revenue bonds. And if I remember correctly, years ago when I was involved in economic development, so we used those for pollution control equipment for private companies where they could. I'm just trying to understand. So is that the type of thing?
Through the chair, that's one example of a small business loan. Oh, it may not be such a small loan. We did that for Georgia Pacific many, many years ago. But there are some limitations for small industrial users, and federal tax law has limited number to, I think, small manufacturing. I know it went from 5 to 10, and I don't know if it's gone even higher. We don't see a tremendous amount of activity in that area. Mm-hmm. Frankly, the private sector probably has less rules and restrictions, and we only offer that tax exemption if they create more jobs than we lose in terms of state tax exemption.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Please go ahead.
This is just a nice picture, but it sort of gives you a good summary of those different types of bonds that I mentioned and over the last decade, and you can kind of see how much our overall debt levels have grown. The red shows you revenue bonds. The green are the appropriation credits, which is a combination of the COPs and the deficit bonds that were done in 2003. The two blues represent two different aspects of GO bonds. The pension obligation bonds that were sold in 2004 are a type of GO bond. The voters approved us selling them in a GO bond fashion rather than an appropriation fashion because of the lower interest rate. So you add those two together and you can see that the big pop in 2004 was for the POBs. And I have more slides with more at a higher level of granularity. So let's look at GO bonds. Hopefully that's big enough for you to see. 10 years ago, believe it or not, we had just over $2 billion in GO debt outstanding. And most of it was for Veterans Affairs. It was Veterans Mortgage Loans, which used to be a huge, huge program. And it's been slowly unwinding because under federal tax law, there's very limited new authority. There's only 5 states that can even sell tax-exempt bonds for mortgages, for vets' mortgages in the country, and we're one of those 5 states. So you can see the big green, which is when the pension obligations bonds were sold, and that was in 2004. And then really the only major change has been that we've been selling a lot of bonds for higher ed over the last few years. And this is both the Article 11F1 bonds, which are self-supporting, revenue-based auxiliary bonds for various auxiliaries throughout the campuses, and then 11G bonds, which are the ones where there's a 50% match, as well as community college bonds, which are another form of 11G, and then we did $200 million-plus for Oregon Health Sciences University when they expanded their campus.
And so the self-support ones, an example of that might be a residence hall?
Correct. That's what 11F1 is for. So as we talk about a lot of university bonds and some other committees, we're talking about revenue bonds, and I'm going to be speaking about making sure that the GO bonds, which we've called self-supporting, which we haven't really worried about, that we have first lien on all those revenue streams, because in the future, if they break away and they pledge that same stream of revenue, we want to make sure that we're first in line before bondholders. Otherwise, they'll become general fund supported bonds, which I don't think anyone wants. The orange on the very top.
Oh, we have a question, Representative Betts.
Yeah.
Thank you, and thank you for this presentation. You're very likely going to get to this, but since it's so obvious from that chart, we must have done something in 2000, and we can't read the date.
Four is the second one. Yeah.
That's the green.
The green.
Pension obligation bonds.
Right, and I understand what we did, but the. Are you going to get to our bonding capacity and the discussion that must have occurred then because of our utilization, such a large amount of it?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
The last point I wanted to make on this page was that in the 2009 legislative session, we started talking about what I mentioned before, which is we have a lot of COPs outstanding for things like prisons, mental hospitals, et cetera, which didn't get the high-quality credit rating at the same level, the lowest interest rates. And so you may remember the legislature passed opportunity for the voters who voted yes and were smart enough to say yes at a very good moment in 2010. We started selling Article Q bonds, which is sort of the cats and dogs for everything else. And we've been refunding a lot of the COPs at really great interest rates, at better credit ratings than we were when we sold the COPs, plus the fact that we got the notch increase. And so we've just sort of calculated, we've already refunded $575 million in the last 2.5 years and saved taxpayers $72 million in cash flow savings just from this one decision that you all decided to go ahead and put on the ballot. So that's what the little orange on top is, and hopefully the appropriation deficit, the appropriation bonds sort of shrink away in the future. Ironically, with the credit market being really challenging in the last few years, it was a perfect time to go to a GO from that perspective as well. So pat on the back to ourselves.
And an additional question, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the fact that you had worked to protect our credit rating over all those years and then get us through the 2008 debacle lent greatly to that rating, and we want to make sure you understand our gratitude for that, because we really are happy for that $72 million, and we're very happy you're not charging a lawyer's rate for having collected.
I was going to talk to you about bonuses later, but thank you. I think that, you know, and I really not brown-nosing, but through the chair to Representative Benz, the credit rating improvements that we've seen, really, I got here in 04. We were in the bottom. Okay, we were third lowest in the country with California and Louisiana. The legislature and the governor, various people, have worked very hard to create strong rainy day funds, balanced budgets. When the revenues were down, the legislature did what it needed to do to cut, and all of those things show. And I can articulate how we run our organization financially, our accounting divisions and DAS and the legislature and the governor, but it's what you all do that makes it easier to get those rating upgrades, and we've gotten several, and we're now in the top tier. We're not going to be a AAA unless we have a sales tax and a huge rainy day fund. Just isn't going to happen. But I think we've got as high a credit ratings with all three rating agencies. We're AA+, AA1, and that's a testimony to good financial management. S&P puts us in the top category as a state for our financial management practices. Yeah, but you're only as good as what you did last week, so I warn you in advance.
Well, the follow-up is that it's challenging sometimes to put the value of that rating into numbers and then translate it into thus the available funds for other things that we try to do around here. And so that's just huge, because that translates almost instantly into not as much debt service and thus more available for, let's say,
correct,
education.
And I think as we talk about lottery, in a few minutes I'm going to go to the lottery, you'll start seeing, I show you the change in interest rates and the change in revenues and how that all plays into leverage and how what we're able to do with limited resources. So it is true. I'm a big, you know, I have a big picture in my office for a number of years with a AAA on it just to motivate my staff. that was our goal. But, yeah, I've kind of thrown the towel. We're about where we're going to be. So.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Well, I also appreciate what you do, because it's kind of, numbers is certainly a wonky thing. But my question is, you know, in the last legislative session, we left a very large ending fund balance. We did not leverage every dime in bonding capacity. And we certainly saw in the last revenue forecast that just came out that that has had a positive impact. What has that done in the credit market world as you guys go out and look at financing? Did that make an impact?
Through the chair, we're a stable AA1. Washington State is kind of not a stable AA1. You know, they've had endless, if you read the papers, problems with revenues declining. Yes, it absolutely did. We market everything that the legislature and the governor choose to do in the most positive light. The best way to sort of describe it is that a few years ago, when we had the American Recovery Act, we were able to sell taxable bonds and then get a subsidy back from the feds. And so we were, you know, with tax exemption in different states, Washington doesn't have it, we do. Sometimes it's hard to say, did we get a better rate to some index than some other state? But taxable bonds, everybody's in the same boat. And when we sold some GO bonds that were taxable and got the subsidy, At the time that we priced, we were the tightest spread, if you would, to Treasury of any state in the country that had come to market. Missouri, which is a true AAA, beat us later. But at the time, ODOT as well was the highest rated state highway fund and got the tightest spreads. So I was very proud of the ability to tell the story in Oregon of how we run our business. It made a difference, and you could see it quantifiably.
So do you have a way to show us the impact from that session? And obviously not today, but something that you can...
I can try to put some things together for you. It's very wonky.
It is wonky, and I get it.
Let me work on it. I have to say it's been a few years for me to go back. An easier way to show you is like for every 10 basis points we save this much in debt service per million, and you'll just have to trust me how much we're saving. Okay. So maybe I'll come up with some simple rules of thumb for you.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I think in that conversation, it's important to think about both sides of that. Having not spent or bonded for something means that there's additional capacity, but it also means that we didn't get the benefit of whatever we didn't invest in, whether that's community colleges or transportation infrastructure or anything else. So that's a pretty hard, I imagine, if I were asked that question, it would be hard to answer the what if we had done it, depending on what we bonded for and all that. So I'm just cautioning in my own mind how the answer to that question
and
might turn out.
Through the chair, I would reflect that too. Sometimes it's not about the best credit rating, it's about the optimal credit rating for what you want to get done. And we sometimes do that with ODOT, where we went with a little lower credit rating, but we could leverage dollars further.
Representative Cameron?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And speaking of wonky, I've been serving with Representative Bent, so I'm okay with wonky. It's a compliment.
Thank you.
You briefly touched on two words. I won't mention the second word. The first word was rainy day fund. If we had a really big, large rainy day fund, it would help us get to a AAA. Do you know what that number is? Or what percentage of the general fund is that we would have to have in a rainy day fund?
I can help with that, too.
I'm going to defer to the chair. I think there's no perfect number, but I think at least 10% would be smart. But I think it's also the diversity of revenue streams. In general, the rating agencies like more. And we don't have a huge federal footprint in our state, so states like Virginia, Maryland, and Tennessee just get it because the federal government is located there. However, they're all in credit watch because if the sequestration kicks in, it cuts both ways. So there's a lot of things that go into it. But I think that, you know, the rule of thumb is it would be great if we could get more than 1 or 2%. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. I think I'm the only one on the committee who got to serve on the Governor Kulongoski's Revenue Restructuring Task Force. And we spent a lot of time talking about just exactly that question. And what we decided was that the best way to think about it was to come up with a rainy day fund that would cover 90% of the recessions that we'd seen over the course of the available data. And that turned out to be about 15% of the general fund. So that would be the optimal according to that process. And it didn't have to be in a single source. Of course, we have, in theory, we have the Education Stability Fund, which hasn't yet gotten to its cap, but would be capped at 10% of the general fund. So if that got full and we had an additional 5 to 10%, that would do well.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay. In interest of time, I do have a doctor's appointment. Okay.
We'll keep our questions to a minimum now. Thanks.
So let's just briefly look at the revenue bond program. As I mentioned, these are the direct streams of revenue that are directly pledged. And you can see that's been a big growing piece. The biggest piece, again, I'm sorry, these are sort of small slides. Oh, you know, I do have handouts. I just realized maybe that would be good if someone could.
Thanks.
I did bring them. I just forgot to hand them out. Is the green, which is the ODOT program. And you can see how small it was in 03 as we were just gearing up to do OTIA 1, 2, and 3.
Oh.
And how it's grown. The housing program, which was asked about earlier by Representative Nathanson, has shrunk a bit, particularly since 2008. It's awfully tough to be selling first-time home buyer mortgages when everybody's losing their jobs. And our lottery bond program is what's in red. So we're going to talk about some of the categories that we look at in the general fund, and this is something that some folks asked about when you were asking about pension obligation bonds and sort of what's inside the general fund debt capacity and what's not inside of it. The SDPAC chose to use 5% of general fund revenues as the debt limit. So when we look at all this general fund debt, and I'll show you the categories, our goal is to keep general fund debt service as a percentage of operating revenues at no higher than 5%. It's not magic. You could have picked 6. We could have picked 4. Different states have chosen. But the rule of thumb around the country is roughly 5. You aren't going to get downgraded if you go a little above it. You certainly aren't going to be able to do all the projects you want if you go below it. So that has sort of been our rule of thumb since the program began in the 90s. We're going to talk about lottery debt and briefly about some other ratios that the rating agencies look at. So general fund. This is a table of all the different debt that's considered general fund supported. You can see most of it's the general obligation debt. Sometimes it's not 100%. Someone mentioned pollution control. Well, it's only a portion of pollution control because a number of the pollution control bonds we sell have loans attached to them. And so that portion we consider self-supporting. And then there's some that are for the orphan sites that the general fund picks up the debt service. So we've done that throughout, whether it's SELP, where there's a portion that's paid, really it's higher ed projects that were deferred maintenance. We started acknowledging that. 32% of POBs, and why did we pick that percentage? Well, we have a payroll system that can allocate that debt service out across all the state agencies. And when you do that and you say, well, how much of that debt service is allocated, it turns out it's about general fund pays 32%. The rest is paid by state agencies that are not in the general fund. So that is, you know, an important number. And then it shows that the seismic grant program that we've just started, and about 85% of the Q bonds. There are certain state agencies that are not in the general fund that have taken advantage of Q bonds as well as the COPs. The big category that I think will be coming, you might all acknowledge, is Article 11P. And that was passed a few years ago by the voters to allow us to do matching bonds for schools, K-12. And there are some bills that I've seen in this legislative session that would begin to utilize some of those funds. So as of June 30th, last year, we were at $2.9 billion based on this methodology. I think it's important to note the appropriation deficit bonds that were sold in 2003 will be paid in full on September 1st, 2013, and will not be on this chart the next time I show you this presentation. And what you're going to see is that it's going to free up a lot of debt capacity, which we didn't have this past biennium because our revenues had dropped and we were at the 5% limit, and so we needed to kind of hold back this biennium. So in the model that we presented last month, these are all the different bond programs that were authorized because we held back and didn't sell all the bonds in back, I think, like at the end of 2010, fiscal year 10. We held back, but we did need to finish up a few buildings, including the State Mental Hospital. And you can see there was just some small amounts for various other programs. We use the OEA General Fund forecast, and now it's an 8-year out forecast.
The Office of Economic Analysis.
Yes, sir. Excuse me.
No problem.
And so we're using that forecast, and then one of the tricky parts for me is to pick the debt service is to pick an interest rate. So what we typically do, because I have a real crystal ball that knows which way things are going, I'm always wrong, but we use a 5-year rolling average of what's known as the Bond Buyer 20, which is a market basket of long-term bonds of lots of AA-rated credits. And so it's the 5-year average is 4.4%. Now, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when I was selling bonds, that was a ridiculously low number. You'll be surprised to know when we sold GO bonds for the state 2 weeks ago, our all-in cost of funds was 2.79%. So I think I'm being conservative. But again, this is a long-term number. And so we've bounced around between fours and fives. I think for budgeting purposes, DAS might still be using 6, but I don't know if that's the case.
How often is that average updated?
Well, we keep it weekly, and so once a year we just take the five, we just roll it forward. And sometimes when interest rates have been crazy, I've added 50 to 100 basis points. As I said, I've always been wrong. Whenever I add 50 basis points, rates drop. If I don't add it, then rates go up. So that's all I can tell you. But I have no reason to believe at the moment that rates are going skyrocketing. Again, it's a 2.79. I know they're going to go higher than 2.79, but whether within the forecast. The good news is every year we do this, and so every year we can fine-tune where we are.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Cameron.
A GO bond is amortized generally 20 years?
Through the chair, yes and no. A lot of our bonds are in the 20 to 25% range. In terms of years, we have some university stuff, we go 30, but then we have equipment, and that goes 6 or 7. So we try and average out about 20 to 25. Right now, the yield curve is so flat that it's
just the ones you referred to about last week.
Those were mostly refunding, so it was a little shorter. We were refunding the COPs. I don't know off the top of my head what the average life, but I think the average life was 12 years, but the final maturities were 28 or so. So,
thank you.
Okay.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Could you give, or do you have an idea, or could you pull it out for the committee later of I don't even know how to ask the question, expected maturity dates on the outstanding debt at this point? Because we've been talking about total debt load and total debt service coverage ratio.
When you get but there's your also book, it's all in the back of your book, all the debt service for the whole state in any way you want it. If you had specific programs, I'd be happy to do it, but we have summary tables that give you all that.
Okay, thank you.
No problem. Planning ahead. So this is sort of the summary chart. As I mentioned, this fiscal year, as well as the previous one, we were a little bit above the 5% ratio. Obviously, we haven't updated this report with the newest revenue forecast. The ratio would be better to the good, but this was based on the December forecast. Going forward, we're paying off the deficit bonds, and that's going to reduce our annual debt service by something in the neighborhood of $60 or $70 million a year. Revenues are growing. So what you can see is on a year-by-year basis, based on the debt we have currently that's general fund, the issuance of the bonds that have already been authorized, paying off old debt, this is what we estimate could be additional new debt at the 5% level. But we don't think that you ought to go out and do $1.2 billion right away, even though that's what the numbers say, because we're not saying you should go to the 5%. So what we try and do is average it out. We say, okay, what's the 8 years? It's $3.6 billion. So let's divide by four bienniums. And that's really how we get to a maximum debt load. So you can see that the general fund debt capacity that we're recommending is the maximum would be about $900 million. Let me go back and just remind you, if you add the two numbers together for 14 and 15, it's a bit higher. And the reason we're doing that is for a number of things. First of all, every dollar you tie up in debt services dollars you can't spend in operations. But also we think that if there's changes in the general fund, you should sort of see where the ratios would go. So we show you just some sensitivity. If there's a 10% decline in the long-term forecast, not in any one year, but the whole 8 years, debt capacity drops by just under $200 million. But also if interest rates are wrong, if I once again pick the wrong interest rate, for example, if rates long-term go higher, you've lost about $70 million, give or take, in capacity. So this is how we kind of get to the number. And you're going to hear in a few minutes from the governor's folks about their planning process. And I provided some of this information to them as they started developing their long-term capital plans around the same 10-year horizon. If it's okay, I'm going to move on to lottery.
Yep, please do.
So lottery bonds have funded everything you can think of. It's a great revenue stream because no state agency, in particular local government, is responsible for generating the revenue. But at the same token, we can use it to grant for all sorts of economic development. You can see over the years it's just been used for every kind of thing you can think of that most people smile and think was a really good idea. So it's everybody's favorite go-to revenue source and bonding program. And we have about $1.1 billion outstanding as of the end of the fiscal year. We go through the same analysis in the model, and we use the same interest rates. We use the same 20-year bonding assumption. In this case, we really only sell bonds with a term of 20 years because it's a little bit more of a risky revenue stream, and investors, you know, are a little more concerned. We also have a coverage factor on it. We don't allow, it's 4x coverage, which what that translates into, no more than 25% of net lottery proceeds transferred to the state are tied up in debt service. Well, since we did the report last year, the lottery revenue forecasts have dropped substantially. I'm not sure if your committee has heard about it or other committees have heard about it, but the lottery program is going to need to replace its video lottery machines that are roughly 8 years old. And in order to do that, they're going to be transferring fewer dollars in the next few years to the state than they might otherwise do. And when you look at it on an 8-year basis, that's a reduction from last year's report where we said, hey, we're going to have like $250 million per biennium as far as the eye can see. And so the forecast has dropped a bit based on that. We're going to need to sell some bonds in about a month and a half. we think we're going to get a good interest rate, but we're going to need to defer principal for a couple of years longer in before we start paying back the principal in order to kind of get through this little rough patch, because we're really close to our four times coverage as we speak. So this just shows you how much. Now, granted, that 400 on the y-axis, if I had it at zero, it wouldn't look like such a big drop. But I just, you know, relatively speaking, when you have to have four times coverage, whatever little change in net proceeds gets magnified four times fold in terms of what you can do with leverage. Our model assumes we're going to sell all $207 million that the legislature has authorized. This is both in the 11th session and the 12th session, because there was some dollars added in the 12th session that said you can sell those. I think it was for community colleges, but you better make sure that there's still capacity. And we think we can. But it's going to have an impact. As I said, we're just barely at 4.1 coverage after we sell those bonds. And based on the fact that proceeds are going to drop, we're going to be in a position to not really be in a position to sell lottery bonds unless we choose to go below the four times coverage, which we could do, but because it's an indenture decision. But the legislature and the SDPAC has, at least to this point, decided they didn't want us to dip any further into lottery. We could open up a junior indenture with a three times coverage or something.
Representative Cameron?
And out of respect, I think you said you had to leave, so I don't want to.
Okay.
Maybe you can get back to this answer, but if we were to pass legislation that required other percentages of lottery funds to go to other places, how would that impact that? Maybe you can give an answer offline.
Oh, absolutely. In the Constitution, the first drop of money must be to pay debt service. So you can choose to do what you want, but at the end of the day, all debt service gets paid first. Constitutionally, there's also percentages that go to, Educational Stability Fund and Parks and Rec. So, again, as long as this much debt service, you know, 25% is kind of out there, unless you throttle it back, we'll be fine. I've seen a couple of bills that talk about other allocations. It's really other agencies in the state that would be affected by the putting bumpers around it.
Thank you.
Representative Benz.
The impact on the credit rating if we fell below the four?
Well, if I had to open up a junior indenture with a three times coverage, it would be at a lower rating. And it's very much what we did with ODOT. We had a three times coverage for their senior lien, and that's AAA and AA1. And then the junior lien is a notch lower.
All right.
And we chose two times. So as we said, we can accommodate if the legislature said they wanted to do a lot of lottery bonding. But the SDPAC and the legislature to this point has not asked us to bond more than this amount. So this capacity analysis is built around an assumption that we continue on. In the second year of the biennium, we free up some capacity. We paid off some bonds. But you can see that because there's less money being transferred, we'll only have about $151 million. Available. That capacity comes roaring right back to life as we're no longer needing to to do the video lottery replacement program. So you can see that later in the long-term forecast, we're back in the neighborhood of sort of where we were before. And on a per biennium basis, excluding this coming biennium, it's roughly 245, and I think we used to say about 250. So we're sort of still in the same boat. But again, as interest rates either go up or down, or revenues over that long period decline, which could happen, there's at least one bill that would suggest putting a permanent kibosh on growth in lottery revenue. It would have a really huge impact. And since I can't be here for your 2167 hearing, I just want you to know I did a back of the envelope, assuming that revenues do not increase beyond what the current biennium for all the future. So your only debt capacity will be new as old debt gets paid off, and it will shrink lottery debt capacity to roughly $89 million per biennium for the foreseeable future.
Please go ahead.
Any other lottery bond questions?
We'll try to get you on your way.
Okay, I'm doing okay. I have 15 minutes, I'm good.
Okay.
So tax-supported debt is how the rating agencies look to try and compare different states, because some states have revenue bonds, some people do GOs. So they say, let's just sort of look at everything that's just tax-supported so we can compare the debt load of Oregon to Washington to everybody else. So what we need to add back in is the balance of our pension obligation bonds, because they're full faith and credit of the state, even though other state agencies pay them. We add in all the COPs and Q bonds that were kind of off in the state agencies. We have to add in our lottery revenue bonds. And unfortunately, we have to add in our highway user tax bonds. We've argued vigorously with them that since it's a constitutionally segregated account, it shouldn't count. And ourselves and Texas are two states that have that way. I've lost. So some of our ratios look really high. And I'll show you sort of Moody's in a moment, sort of how that works out. But overall, I think debt is stabilizing. You can see when you look at all that net tax-supported debt, 12 and 13, it's about the same. And partly it's because we stopped issuing new bonds in general fund for the last year. We've been paying off debt. And so we're roughly at about the same place. We also look at it with and without our pension bonds because not every state sold pension bonds to fund their unfunded liabilities. So we chose to do it. It went onto the balance sheet. So we're much higher than the median state in the Moody's medians because our state chose to do that. Now, of course, not every state had the benefit levels. It led to unfunded liabilities either. So kind of it's a little hard to compare directly, but if you wanted to look at what it was without the pension bonds, what you're noticing is actually that our debt load is declining. The reason in part is because, those bonds are amortizing relatively slowly. I'll leave it. I think that's the simple answer. So this is just sort of a graphic picture. The green bars show you Moody's median, so that's all 50 states, and it shows you that when they look at all 50 states as a percentage of personal income, which is an attempt to try and sort of standardize, that the median has been bouncing between about 2.5 to 2.8 for the last few years. And what I try to do here is just show you the different colors of the different types of bonds that we've talked about today. The POBs at the very top, and clearly the POBs pushed us way over the medians even back in 04. The blue represents this ODOT debt that I was talking about. So if you sort of strip those two away, we're kind of at the medians for all the other COP, lottery, and GO debt that we have. But clearly, we're much higher. We're somewhere in the neighborhood of the 11th highest in terms of debt in the Moody's medians. What's interesting is they see that we have higher than average debt. S&P thinks that we have moderate debt, and Fitch is somewhere in the middle. So out of all the different things that rating agencies evaluate, different firms look at these things in different ways.
I may be the only one who has this issue, but I just want to make sure I'm understanding the graph correctly. Are those cumulative? So at the very top,
yes, that's all of our debt. Yeah, I'm just trying to show you the layers.
The components.
The layers.
Great.
And that little wedge that you're seeing is, I'm sorry, the colors don't really do it, but we're dropping that blue, which is our COPs, and what's replacing it are the Qs. So that sort of stayed constant throughout.
Got it.
But I just think it's useful because you can see really what's driving our debt ratios and whether you think it's good or bad. I think the ODOT improvements and investments we've made, some of the lottery bond that we've done, and this is your committee, which is Transportation and Economic Development, those were good investments in the future of the state. And so sometimes you have to invest before you get to see the return. And the tricky part, as you're going to hear about, is how do we choose to invest our capacity in the future to get the maximum return on our dollar. These are just a list of some of the non-tax supported. These are the ones that we've talked about that are the self-supporting, whether they're GO bonds or direct revenue or conduit. And the goal is that you never hear about these because they're always in great shape and they're well-funded and there's no problems. And so I'll just leave it at that. These are the programs, and there's more information in our report about those programs, and we're always happy to tell you more if you're interested. The Treasurer's Office is responsible for reviewing cash flows. So even when those programs are run well, every time we sell bonds for housing or we sell bonds for energy, we go over all their cash flows. And so we've been pointing out that the sell program is going to have some cash flow problems in a couple of years and been trying to highlight that in our reports so that everybody has a heads up on looking at solutions in the short run and in the long run to make sure that they can continue to be a self-supporting program. So that's really my presentation. 902 for the next biennium is what we think is a maximum general fund, about $151 million in lottery bonds. And our tax-supported debt ratios are stabilizing, although they're way higher than the national average.
Thank you. Leaves us with, about 8 minutes maybe for questions, if there are any. Representative Benz.
I'm sorry, you may have said this, but when are the POBs paid off?
I believe they're paid off in full, I want to say in 2028 or 2029. I think they were 25-year bonds.
I wonder if you could give us just a little more detail on some of the kinds of bonds that the Facilities Authority helps facilitate.
Through the chair, the Oregon Facilities Authority is a conduit borrower. The state treasurer appoints the members. We have seven members from different walks of life who either know a lot about construction or finance or nonprofits. The Facilities Authority sells bonds for nonprofits like the various health authorities around the state. So, for example, we've done things for Providence. We've done things for Kaiser. But you can think of the nonprofit healthcare providers around the state, and so they come through us. We do a lot of work with private nonprofit colleges: Linfield, Willamette, Lewis and Clark, University of Portland. So we sell their bonds if they want to come through us. They can also go through a county conduit. But we try and be the best issuer with really good procedures and policies and technical assistance. We also have a new program we started a few years ago. We're doing private placements for smaller nonprofits. And this is really, really the tiny stuff. This is maybe not tiny on a personal level, but relative to bonding. So we're talking the $5 million and less. There's a nonprofit that has a mortgage with a bank. We're able to basically wrap that mortgage with tax exemption and get them about 1.5 to 2% lower interest rate than with the same bank, because the bank's able to take advantage of the tax exemption. So we're really pleased and really proud that we've been able to help social service agencies, small schools. We work with the French American School and help finance their projects. And it's just a really weird range. But we're always interested. If you have a project in your region, it's hard for us to know about the projects in Ontario. But we'd love to help small nonprofits. And our program is streamlined, standardized documents so that the costs to the nonprofit are pretty minor compared to the savings.
So it's an important service. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this refreshes my memory of it. The same discussion we had several years ago. And the issue was the cost. And you just need to tell us, or me, where to go look at that cost of those tax-exempt programs, because we had a lengthy discussion about the difference between that type of a program, let's say, and a normal tax exemption. And I don't want to go into it today. I just would like your a direction and where one might look to
see. Paul Warner might be a good person that you and I and he could sit down, because there's tax exemption that's sort of being passed on to those nonprofits, because it's, here's a debt service, and you could guess what their interest rate would be if it wasn't for the state exemption.
Right.
And the same analysis is done every time a project comes through Oregon Business,
right,
as well.
Right. Thank you.
Last question from me. This is obviously not the Ways and Means Committee. Whatever decisions that this committee makes with respect to bonding likely will go to Ways and Means, but we will have some policy opportunities to discuss. And so I wonder if you have any general advice for us as we think about what decisions we might make with respect to bonding.
Through the chair, I'm going to speak a little bit for the treasurer. With Mike not here, I'll channel Ted Wheeler briefly. And as the newest member kind of the organization that's in this building, he was surprised, since he'd worked in county government, that we didn't have a 10-year capital plan or a 5-year capital plan. And I think his first session or two, he's just been surprised that we weren't a little more coordinated in thinking about some of the best uses of our limited debt capacity resource. So something that he's been advocating, that we've been putting in our report, is we need to look very comprehensively at all the schools, all the state buildings, at all of our economic development things, and just make sure whatever we choose as a body to fund is the best use of the money. What's going to raise the state GDP? What's going to raise our educational standards? And to just be very thoughtful about how to accomplish that. And I think he shared that with the governor. And I think that you're, as I said, you'll be hearing a little bit, if you have time for it today, about the governor's executive order, which is to begin that process, the conversation about how we sort of think about bonding as investment and how we make sure collectively that those investments are well placed. When I mentioned that the rating agency meetings we had in January in anticipation for this bond sale, that we were embarking on that, their ears all perked up. They all sat a little straighter in their seats. So I can assure you it's a real credit positive. Some of the states that I've either worked in or been near have had long-term capital plans that are in the AAA. So it's another component in being well-managed. It's not that it's bad to have debt. It's how you use it.
That's an excellent summary and a nice segue, too. So I think we do have just a short time. I know that Representative Tomei and Representative Kenmer are here on their bill, but hopefully you have the capacity to listen and learn with us a little bit about the strategic planning process that the governor has embarked on. I see Steve Marks headed our direction. And as he comes up, we say thank you to you and good luck on your next obligation. And it also gives us a chance to have a little bit of a preview. We have a couple of bills, in addition to the one we'll hear today, that have to do with bonding and strategic planning. So, Mr. Marks, we're glad you're here to give us a preview on what the governor's office is doing.
Well, she's setting that up. Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Steve Marks. I'm a policy advisor in the CO's office, Michael Jordan's office in Oregon, here to represent the policy content of the governor's executive order on strategic plan and infrastructure finance. I'm happy to get rolling in the interest of time.
Sounds great.
I mean, the whole thing here is a very simple proposition. We looked at the amount of bonding capacity that would be available, and is it?
We have it in front of us too.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And here it is. Here you go.
Look at the amount and the growth that's going to be contained there, and you look, and we got about $1 billion of biennium, $5 billion over a 10-year time period. And one of the things that the governor did in looking at plans and outcomes had in place a executive committee on which the treasurer served. And one of the recommendations of that committee that was looking at the budget process said, let's look at a long-term capital plan. So with that, I'll hit the next budget. But so this just says the state needs to be a strategic investor of this money. We need to leverage it to our best advantage, both with using other public funds, private funds, foundation funds, and innovative finance approach and partnerships. So we should make the optimum decisions we can in the interest of our governance. So the executive order tries to establish a process and methodology so that we can have a little bit of discipline to do that. Turned out it was very useful for us to think about because we did it in advance of our budget. So our budget is structured based on what you'll hear about here in terms of its capital. And when I'm talking about the investment, I'm only talking about general fund and lottery funds at this point because that's where we have the least amount of money. Has a big outcome, big idea outcome, and a good one for the state over the next 10 years, create and direct the development of a capital planning process that strategically identifies Oregon's highest value capital investments and provides a sustained and consistent process for financing projects that aligns with achievement of statewide strategic outcomes identified in the 10-year plan, or you could say our 10-year public purposes, right? The consistent financing is an interesting notion, so I want to point out some of the thinking about long-term planning came right out of the multimodal Connect planning process, which has evolved over time to be staged and people cooperate. You look into the future and you can begin to see the investments that are being made in one place and another place over time. So if you think about that kind of process as I go through these other categories, I think you'll get a sense of the kind of longitudinal planning effort that we'd like to put into place. I'd also point out that all I'm talking about in the planning process on the executive side is planning for our capacity. The legislature in the executive order clearly says the legislature executes bonds. You make the sales, we don't, but we can plan around that capacity. So I think this works in tandem, and certainly the executive order provides the flexibility for the CO to make adjustments along the way to meet the legislative will. So it works with the prudent person concepts you've heard and the smoothing that Laura Lockwood McCall just talked about. So we come in and we say we're a prudent person, we move under that and we smooth our planning process for the 10 years so we're at a level that we can sustain. It provides for a general distribution of the planning debt capacity based on historic experience. Some of that doesn't align because this is all at once when you see the percentages, but different areas have been emphasized in different bienniums at different times. But this is based on our historical review of general fund and lottery debt spending. It defines the specific plan spending in some areas, so I call these the designated or reserved categories of planning within those general distributions. as I said before, one of the points here is to be able to plan, to be able to leverage our funding and to think about that kind of process. The emphasis of the process, the coordination of the process in the executive order takes place through the chief operations officer's office. However, on the next slide, as I go through the percentages, we can talk about the governing structure, the distribution of decisions that would be in that process. Education infrastructure would get provided 25% of the capacity. You have the yearly dollar figures there. For state infrastructure, also 25%. Now, I would put in place while the chief operating officer is responsible for coordination, we anticipate that the education infrastructure decisions would be made by the Education Investment Board itself. State infrastructure does fall under the CO's office, so we would look for planning to come out of that office for all the state appropriations, state agency projects. Regional and community infrastructure is dedicated 30% under this arrangement. These tend to be not fall into one central governance. As our budget is executed, the governance by fund is in place.
Just interrupt you for a second. Yes. Representative Nathanson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 25% on state infrastructure. One of the things I've observed over the last 6 years so far is that we see requests come through Ways and Means to invest in fixing something that's so terribly broken. Usually it's information technology, a major system replacement or upgrade, for example. Often it's a building, though, or equipment, where instead of maintaining something over time or collecting reserves, you know, like some places have reserves for replacing automobiles on a routine schedule. Instead of doing that, we let things get to a terrible point so that it costs even more. Meanwhile, it's been costing us money and lost opportunity because we couldn't operate at an optimal level. So is 25% a guess? How much is that compared to how much of our bonding capacity we've been investing over the last 10 or 20 years on state infrastructure? Will that help us catch up with delayed needs? What does 25% mean, you know?
And before you answer, let me just take the opportunity to say we've probably got about 5 or 6 minutes left to kind of, this might give you the sense, a chance to kind of rush through the rest of your
quick
slides.
Do,
That'd
sir.
Be great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathan, I think you'll see an answer that you like about our distribution. These are based on historical levels, but you see we do some spending in those exact areas or anticipate reserving in those exact areas you've identified. Lastly, I'll say there's on this chart that there's a reserve innovation emerging opportunities category. That's 20%. We didn't spend any of that funding on that in the governor's budget proposal of the $1.1 billion accounted initially. $760 million of our capacity is budgeted to be spent, considered by the legislature. So here you see the education planning reserve. So within their 25%, there's a couple of 10-year allocations made here. One's for longitudinal data system for our education so we can understand what our 0 through 20 system expenditures are to improve teacher practices. $35 million of that education fund is put into technology and student achievement centers to distribute educational knowledge and practices through technology. Here is the state allocation. And within this capacity, you'll see for the first time over the 10-year period, we have a reserve specifically for life cycle costs and maintenance. We say of the 25% over the 10-year period, $325 million will be dedicated to bring our assets up where it makes sense. Is that full coverage? No, but that's a significant contribution. More than has been made in the past by a significant measure. Also, over that same period of time, we said there's $125 million of that 10-year period to be spent on our advancements of our technology projects, our budgetary system, our personnel system, to bring those systems up to snuff over the 10-year period. So it makes a consistent investment over time in the improvement of those systems for the state. Here's the regional and community planning capacity. I won't talk about those in detail here. I'll just show you the last chart and then be happy to answer questions sometime if you have them. So this is the chart that shows sort of our current budget execution for only community regional. And you can see in the upper left corner, there's $1.7 million to DAS, $1 million regional planning assistance. That's actually general fund dollars for us to carry out the planning process, to provide technical assistance to the regions. The pots of money that you see, the $20 million in water and wastewater, that's our existing loan program. We actually execute that sale, and the dates are bond sales, where we're targeting roughly in the biennium where the bond sales would occur there. That helps finance, as you see in the first column under the state, May 14, $0.5 million from Business Oregon. The interest earnings on that early sale help us provide a little bit more additional technical assistance to the planning process. The $20 million in infrastructure grants and loans, which we see as loans, are $2 million that go to each regional solutions committee. Those are highly flexible loans, but one of the processes here is that we might advocate that those things be elevated and leveraged to other larger regional economic projects within the region. And then I will just direct you to available regional priority funding. We've started off with $10 million for water development funding. Actually, if you look, the $10 million is $10 million of $180 million in capacity that we would look over the biennium. So that scales up in the next four bienniums because we have greater water development needs. And lastly, I'll just leave you with two other points. $30 million is for regional economic development priorities. That's more of a competitive fund that the regions come to, and we finance the highest sort of regional impact economic projects that we have in place. I want to jump just to the bottom, talk about Connect Oregon, because it's vitally important. The Connect Oregon, because lottery dollars are tight, and you heard about the investments, we have funded $22 million of that $60 million of Connect is backed by lottery funds. We're backing the rest of it with certificates of participation, as is the Lane Transit District, $17 million. Now, we'll need a slight change in the COP law to execute that. And that's because it has to be publicly owned by the state. And we can say it needs to be publicly owned and transfer that to a local public entity. But we can't use the COP funds in conjunction with privates. I'd be happy to return to the committee and answer any questions for members when you have
Thank you. And I suspect we will invite you back because we have, obviously, on Friday, we will hear a bill related to Connect Oregon. And I think at a future date, we'll hear a bill that is built on the executive order, which we have in front of us as well for your review. Recognizing that we're keeping two of our colleagues waiting, are there any quick questions for Mr. Marks? Thank you for the preview. Yeah. We will have you back, I suspect.
And I just would say two things for your understanding. One is that innovative finance is definitely a part of this effort, and the bill you'll be hearing on Western States Exchange is definitely covered within the executive order coordination, as is the idea in the future, if we can get this general fund lottery planning process up to snuff, that we will mesh it then with other funds, asset planning processes. Right.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And with that, and one more note that this is just the first step in this conversation, we'll close the informational meeting on bonding and open a public hearing on House Bill 2167. Troy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2167 establishes a biennial goal amount of net proceeds raised from lottery games for purposes of creating jobs, furthering economic development, financing public education in Oregon, and restoring and protecting parks, beaches, watersheds, and native fish and wildlife. Caps amount of net proceeds of Oregon State Lottery that can be spent without approval of supermajority vote of chambers of Legislative Assembly. Establishes Oregon Rainy Day Lottery Fund. Amends Oregon Revised Statutes 461 regarding Oregon State Lottery operation and finances.
Thank you, and hopefully you can see the connection between the bonding discussion we've been having and the lottery policy discussion we're about to have. Representative Tomei, Representative Kenmer, thank you for your patience. We're glad to hear from you.
Thank you for allowing us to be here today. For the record, I'm State Representative Carolyn Tomei, represent House District 41, which is Milwaukee, Oak Grove, and parts of Southeast Portland. Gambling and gambling addictions have frequently been in the news lately. We've heard about the woman who embezzled money from the city of West Lynn. I think that was $1 million. And we know there was embezzlement in the city of, in East County.
Estacada.
Thank you very much. And last week there was a story of the former mayor of San Diego who gambled $1 billion. Losing hundreds of millions of dollars. Because of this growing problem, last session, the House Human Services Committee established a problem gambling workgroup to better understand the issues surrounding gambling addiction and make recommendations for legislation to reduce the incidence of gambling addictions and mitigate the harms that gambling causes in our state. Representative Parrish and Representative Kenny Geyer, who is next door, Representative Kennemer and I met with many stakeholders, both in private and as a whole group. Stakeholders included Larry Nicewander, the Oregon Lottery Director, several individual lottery commissioners, gambling specialists in our Addictions and Mental Health Division, problem gambling experts, representative from the Oregon Restaurant Association, treatment providers, and addicted gamblers. We came up with several proposals that have been referred to the Human Services Committee, increasing expertise on mental health and addictions within the Lottery Administration, and establishing a treatment funding floor so that treatment providers know they have a baseline for providing service. But this measure, 2167, has come to your committee. In the course of our work group, it became apparent that not only individual gamblers have gambling addictions, but that our state itself is addicted to gambling. We continually ask the lottery to supply more dollars for more services, and I know you've been hearing that today, and you will be hearing that in the future. We expect the lottery to behave responsibly in its marketing practices, while at the same time, we demand more revenue. The goal of 2167 is to curb the state's reliance on gambling dollars. It sets a cap on the amount of money the state will allocate from lottery revenue. The limit is being set at the 2011-2013 biennium. If the lottery produces more revenue than that, the money will go into a rainy day fund to be used during times of economic downturn. But there will be no more mixed messages. Now we give the message to the Lottery Commission, raise us more money, but don't get people addicted to gambling. There will be no more mixed messages, no more pressure on the lottery to increase its revenue. Problem gambling addiction are real. These are serious problems for our state. This is a hidden addiction which causes marriages to disintegrate, families to lose their homes, pilfered retirement funds, and even criminal embezzlement. There's a lot of shame that goes with this addiction. All of us know people, even in this building, maybe in this room, who acknowledge that they are recovering addicts to alcohol or other drugs. But I'll bet.
I'll take it.
And our language is so pervasive. Probably none of us knows anyone who will admit to a gambling addiction. I had a mental health expert from one of our counties to present an overview of this issue today. I think we've sent some written information to you. Problem gambling in Oregon and Oregon health concerns. Do you have this in your packet? If not, we will make sure that you get this. Unfortunately, she works for a county that is very dependent on lottery revenue, and they asked her not to come to testify in support of this bill. So her county employers are addicted to gambling dollars also. They see this as an economic development issue. They want more lottery dollars. I think education, probably all of the groups that we give lottery money to would like more lottery dollars. And this bill starts to put the brakes on government reliance. Colleagues, we must break this cycle now. Let's work to stop gambling addiction. Now is the time to stop our state and our local governments from preying on the most vulnerable citizens. Please pass House Bill 2167 to lessen our government's addiction to gambling.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. For the record, Bill Kenemer, State Representative, District 39. Representative Tomei has been quite a leader and has helped with our group, and we appreciate Representative Parrish and Representative Kenny Geyer working on this topic. As you know, my background is as a psychologist, and incidentally, the charge for us is the best interests of the public, and incidentally, for the lottery, it's commensurate with public good. And the lottery does do a lot of good things, and you help make sure that they do, and you monitor what they do, and you decide who gets what portions of that. And I think that's a healthy and good process. I also think, in light of the fabulous success that Prohibition was, trying to abolish some of these human problems like gambling is unrealistic too. And I think the Oregon Lottery was a dramatic improvement over the gray games that we used to have. And there were a lot of backroom card games and a lot of pressure and some interesting collection issues and a whole bunch of things that we didn't talk about. This was a marvelous improvement. And, you know, that $1.1 billion makes a difference in this world. On the other hand, there's another side to this story. And that, I think, is a very serious side. You know, we talked about the fact that, well, let me just go a different direction. Currently, the estimate last session was that there are 77,000 folks who are addicted to gambling in Oregon. 77,000. That's quite a number. But I think the part that really bothers me, and I think will probably upset you, is that it's estimated that of those 77,000, 65,000 are addicted to Oregon Lottery, Video Lottery, Oregon Video Lottery, 65,000 people. And not only that, but it's not just 65, because most of those people have families. And not only that, but some of them embezzled, as we talked about, from West Lynn or Estacada or wherever. And the other thing I find, serving on the business committee and talking to some of the business community, is that there's often embezzling from all kinds of businesses, too. And as a general rule, it's not reported because you don't really want that to be known about your business. So I don't know what the magnitude of that is, but I know that the injury is very substantial. Representative Tomei talked about addiction, and I guess I think that this bill is our effort at intervention. That's what you do with addictions. You treat them with intervention. And I think we need to look at intervention. We need to do something about the 65,000 people. I don't know that we can do much about them, but maybe we can slow this down, because if we keep allowing this to expand each year, we just addict more. And when is enough enough? Well, I think it was enough quite a while ago. But the realities are we are where we are, and that's why we proposed the current limit. I think it makes sense to have that current limit. And a couple of things about that. One of the things that has been exciting is to see the lottery change a little bit of its focus. And you remember some of us got pretty darned upset when, at the beginning of the recession, when their revenue started to fall, they started to advertise this very addictive process. And fortunately, wisdom prevailed and they withdrew that. But if you watch some of the new commercials, I kind of like them. They show someone getting their phone out and you're supposed to dial in how long you're going to gamble and to set a limit. What does this bill do? This bill helps us set a limit. How much is enough? I'm not sure I know the answer, but certainly a billion one must be getting pretty close to it. So let's set the limit. Let's follow the way you treat addictions. Let's set a limit. Let's talk about it openly. Let's confront it. Let's admit that it is a problem, and let's do something about it. And so that's the nature in which we bring this before you today. I appreciate your listening so patiently. Balancing is the tough job that we have, and I think this bill offers you that opportunity to help us find that balance of some money that we wouldn't otherwise have, on the other hand, minimizing the damage and maximizing the best interests of the public. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Parrish.
Thanks. So, first of all, I appreciate the work of this committee. We met a lot. I also appreciate the work of our lottery director, whose hands are bound by the language in the law to measure it with the public good. So they, you know, his job is to, right now, is to maximize the value of the lottery. And full disclosure, I dropped a lottery bill today. But the fact of it is that right now his directive is make money, make money, make money. And the problem gambling piece is huge. West Glen's my district where the woman took $1.2 million from our city coffers, and, you know, the lottery didn't write us back a check. But that's where her money went. It all went to the video poker piece. You know, the lottery, I've taken very public issue with the advertising spend of the lottery. It's, you know, $26 million and some change. And a big piece of it doesn't go to the problem gambling ads that Bill's seeing. Representative Kinnamer's seeing. I've seen those ads. I think they're great. I think that campaign of Set the Limit is fantastic, and you guys have done a good job with that. But I'm not a big fan of some of the other, you know, does good things piece, because it really doesn't do as much good as we'd like it to be doing. When in 2010 there were 1,500 folks who called our state lottery helpline that's on the machine, so these were people playing our video poker terminals, 1,500 of them went into state-sponsored treatment, and the aggregate losses for those 1,500 people, they self-reported $37 million in gambling debt for 1,500 people. So when we talk about bonding and some of those things, I think it's important to note that it's a small population of people paying for that. That doesn't include some of the job loss. I have a woman in my community who darn near went bankrupt when her husband gambled away $250,000, all their life savings. And so when you think about some of those losses, my sister in and out of jail. So, you know, Representative Tomei asked if we knew someone. Yeah, my sister had this problem before she died, and she'd steal your wallet to go and do that, and in and out of our correction system. So I think it is important to look at capping this. I'm absolutely, as part of the work group, in favor of this bill, because I do think it's time. I do think it's time to think about how we start to temper that as we look at that increasing number of people in the problem gambling category. So just, I am very supportive of the work of the work group, and they worked very hard. Restaurant Association worked very hard. I don't know if Bill Perry is going to testify today, you know, but I'm sure he'll tell you that, you know, when we added the sixth terminal, I wasn't here, but when that sixth terminal got added to a restaurant, it wasn't the Restaurant Association asking for that. It was the legislature asking for that. So something to consider as we move forward in this conversation today.
Thank you. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's something I want to ask of the representatives while you're still at the table with us. When I was reading quickly through what I needed to prepare to review today, the staff measure summary begins with a sentence that alarmed me until I understood the intent of what you were trying to accomplish. And I want to make sure there's nothing in the wording of the bill that actually speaks to this concern I have. In the measure summary, it says, establishes biennial goal amount of net proceeds raised from lottery games, et cetera, et cetera. That sounds to me like a goal for let's raise at least this much money, rather than a goal for allocating the proceeds, if you understand the distinction. And so at first I was alarmed, my gosh, if they're not raising at least that much money, because that's the goal, maybe they're going to have to do more marketing and encourage people to gamble more. So I wanted your assurance that there's nothing in the bill that actually sets a goal for we need to raise at least this certain amount of money.
I think that, if I may, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nathanson, I think that is not the intent of the bill, and I will look at it much more closely. I've got it here in front of me. That was certainly not the intent. The intent was to set a cap, and anything over that cap that was raised by the lottery would go into a rainy day fund, and I'm not sure that I stated that.
Thank you. I think the summary probably means a goal for allocating whatever is
right.
Raised.
Okay. Right.
Thank you for that assurance.
Excuse me, if I may, let me add, Mr. Chair and Representative Nathanson. Part of our discussion was how do you engineer a series of gambling events to come to a specific amount of money? And it's pretty hard, you know, and if we're not careful, we ratchet it down in October instead of December 31st for the end of the year, or, you know, you can see the problem.
Yes.
And so the thought was that we would set it consistent with the goal that had already been achieved. That was last biennium's amount.
Right.
So that would become the new target amount. In the event that they make more than that, it would go into a rainy day fund. And then there are limits on how the rainy day fund may be expended, so that it's also not a direct way to bypass the goal of limiting. I think it's a suitable way to try and break the addiction, and yet, you know, you do have to create momentum, and people need to be gambling, and if they take a three-month hiatus, they're probably not going to get started January 1. So that was our thinking, and I think it's a kind of a pragmatic, practical solution.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, if I could make one more statement, we'll make sure you get this information. But this was the Oregon Council on Problem Gambling in 2012. They were set up by the Lottery Commission, and they estimated the annual social cost of problem gambling in Oregon is approximately $508 million. So that's $1.16 billion a biennium. So if you're looking at raising lottery money, it's costing us more than we're raising in lottery money. So just think about that.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
We have three other people who are going to testify. Before you leave, I had two questions as well. I wonder if you could talk about the similarities or differences in the between the lottery, the rainy day lottery fund, and the education stability fund, for example, and the rainy day fund that we have not connected to lottery. That's one question. And then two, you mentioned sort of generally how you established a billion as the limit, but I wonder how open you are to alternative methodologies of establishing what the limit is if the concept goes forward.
If I may, Representative Kinnemer, I think we're not tied to that. I think what we're trying to do is set a floor so that we don't give...
A ceiling, you meant.
I mean, a ceiling. A cap.
Yes.
So that the lottery, we would not be giving the Lottery Commission mixed messages. Raise more money because we need it, but don't get people addicted.
Okay.
So we're wanting to set a cap. So I think we would certainly be open. And as for your first question, I'm sorry, I can't answer that, but I will find out the answer for you.
Thank you. Very good.
I guess just if I may, Mr.
Sure,
I would concur. I think, you know, we're trying to set, but we're open to other alternatives. As we look at it, this just seemed like a reasonable amount. How do you argue with what the goal was last, or what the amount was last time? You know, and frankly, if I set it, it would be a lot lower.
Understood.
But that's not a realistic political response, I don't think. And that's why you're here, is to evaluate whether this is a good idea. And if you have ideas to improve it, I think that's terrific. And would love to see you improve it and send it out.
Understood. Thank you very much.
Thank you, committee and Mr. Chair.
And if I may, just one additional thing. I see the director is here, and I wish to thank him personally.
Yes.
He has been terrific in working with us and taking the time to understand our concerns and helping us be a little better focused and realistic. And I think he faces an incredible challenge dealing with all of the different issues that are related.
Thank you for saying that. We're glad to hear it, and it's a nice segue because he's one of the three people who have signed up. So thank you for thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Director, you're up, and I'll call the other two folks up who have also signed up, and we can hear from you all together. That's Roger Humble and Bill Perry. And I've kind of put you on the spot, but if, Mr. Director, if you're willing to wait, perhaps we want to hear from the other folks who are weigh in on the merits of the bill, and then you can help us understand the implications and how it might work. Mr. Humble, do you want to start?
Thank you, Committee Chair. My name is Roger Humble. I'm a gambling addiction counselor at Bridgeway Recovery Services. And I just came today to kind of speak about the problem gambling in our state and beyond. Representative Tomei spoke to it pretty clearly about a lot of the things. I enclosed, I think it's on some of your things, some of the information I present to families of problem gamblers and problem gamblers, some of the similarities and differences, and some of the costs of problem gambling. And I, in just like to everybody that's involved in this legislation be aware of some of the potential costs. You know, most people understand alcoholism and drug addiction and all the things that go with it, you know, withdrawal and the stuff that goes with it. Well, there's that goes with problem gambling, and then there's some other things that go with it too. Of course, the financial cost and some of the things when somebody goes into an establishment and they're drinking, a bartender can tell pretty quickly that this guy's inebriated. We get his keys. A gambler, there's no overdose. They can gamble and gamble. The mayor of San Diego, $1 billion before anybody realized it. It's a very hidden addiction, and there's no overdose, which is very scary when you think about the financial costs that could potentially come with a gambling addiction. Some of these things there, I put some national numbers together. 60% of addicted gamblers will commit crimes. And in Oregon, we're talking about 1% to 3% of people that gamble that are pathological gamblers. So it is a short number, a low number. But one of the criteria for pathological gambling is committed crimes. And so that is one of the criteria for the disorder. And one desperate gambler can be a one-person crime wave. I've had armed robbers. I've had embezzlers. We get a lot of real estate folks and brokers and different things like that that got themselves in trouble, done prison sentences, gotten out, continue to gamble, back to prison, suicide attempts, hospitalizations, institutions. And the ability to control it or stop it or to set a limit is gone. It is, it is just amazing. Tragic. Some of the things that happen with these addictions. So, I won't take up a lot of time. If there's any questions about this, but I enclose some information. Machine gambling and the technology involved has really changed the game, and that's another thing to really kind of consider. If you look at placing a bet as a dose, the new machines have the ability to get a dose seconds. And so you're getting more and more dose of gambling. And so these machines can be very highly addictive. Almost 100% of the clients we're seeing now are machine gamblers, escape gamblers, that slip into this disassociated state, play, high levels of, high-speed games, disassociate. When they finally come to, they realize their paychecks are gone. They get desperate. They go to the pawn shops. They, pawn in their things, and they're trying to chase their losses and do all this stuff to recoup their already losses. And it's just a really this cycle that they get into is very desperate. And I just wanted to bring that to the attention of the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Perry.
Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant Lodging Association. And before I start, I'll throw out a little trivia question. There's only one member on your panel that I'm aware of that's actually passed a bill to reduce lottery games in the state. And so I'll leave that with you guys to think about as I carry on with my testimony. But I want to talk about kind of the budgetary part. I think you've heard a lot about the addiction part of it, but if you look at the history of video, since we've had video, you really had about an average 4.5% growth a year for a long time. Then what happened, as Representative Parrish said, in the 2003 legislature, legislature passed a bill to basically add a sixth machine, which she is correct, we opposed at that time frame. Then you had line games, which was another artificial increase. And then you also had the smoking ban that came in, I think it was 2007, I can't remember, which was a dramatic decline. Now, the interesting aspect of that is the lottery and us as the retail community told the legislature at the time that was going to be a 15% drop in your lottery revenue, but they didn't budget the decrease. So they've told the lottery, we're going to reduce your take by 15%, but we want you to still give us the same amount of money, which is when the whole advertising for video started. They were trying to find a way to fill that gap. So I didn't like the video advertising on TV. We obviously, it has in our contracts, we can't advertise video. So
But, you know, whether or not it was a right move, they were trying to fulfill a budget number that was expanded by the legislative branch. And so this concept actually originally, when Senator Gordon Smith did the 15% to the education endowment, we actually recommended at that time to take 15% of biennium and put all of the money in an endowment to really kind of, in my opinion, take this example to an extreme. But we've said all along since then you need to cap it, because as you make policy decisions, you shouldn't be making those policy decisions based on a budget number for the lottery. And so if you, what should happen if this gets placed at today's level, and as a, we hopefully don't have any other lottery type issues that come up from a legislative standpoint, I think you'll start to see about a 4% growth in the lottery numbers. So two bienniums from now, three bienniums from now, if you passed a smoking ban or something else, it's not going to impact it, because that number will give you a cushion, and it doesn't, you don't gain anything by trying to increase that number. There's no gain to you. So it basically will change, in my opinion, the policy dynamics around the lottery. You know, the addiction side is bad and everything else, but from a budgetary standpoint, budgeting off the lottery, I just don't think it has ever been a good policy decision. It stabilizes the industry. It takes away the benefits from any actions you might make from it. And so it just, I think overall, it's been a good public policy that we've tried to been pushing for in different facets through the history of the lottery. And with that, I will be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. It's a nice wonder. Maybe we can hear from your perspective sort of the implications and how it might work, and then we can take questions for the whole panel.
Thank you very much, Chair Reed and committee members. For the record, my name is Larry Nicewender. I'm the director of the Oregon Lottery. I want to preface my comments by saying that the lottery is neutral on this bill. We're just here to provide information for your policy consideration and answer any questions you may have and provide a little historical context. So as has been previously alluded to, the lottery has been a source that the budget has relied upon heavily over many years. So I'm glad to see that the subsequent referral of the Ways and Means will give us a chance to sort through a little bit of what effect, if any, this would have on the governor's balanced budget, the co-chair's budget plan that's in development, and then the balanced budget reliance on a lottery-backed bonding. As Laura Lockwood McCall testified, you know, there has been a significant reliance on lottery-backed bonds, $1.1 billion, and proposals to add more. So it is something that does have fiscal implications. So on page 2 of my testimony, I just provide for you a citation of the current law, which is lottery's mission. It was established in law when two initiative measures were passed in 84, and it hasn't been touched since. And it does contain the phrase that's being replaced by this bill that says that the lottery will continue to be operated so as to produce the maximum amount of revenue to benefit public purpose commensurate with the public good. And so the replacement of that language is significant and has not been done heretofore. So I wanted to let you know that even though these words say set the maximum amount of revenue commensurate with the public good, I will tell you that I'm appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, and so are all the five lottery commissioners, and we take that direction very seriously. And this governor has been very clear with me and the commission that he wants us to carry the brand, take care of this stable revenue source. It provides funding for state services, but he is not, and he's publicly said this, he's not an advocate for expansion of gambling or things that might otherwise incite additional problems related to problem gambling. So we have been effectively trying to carry the brand. No new products have been introduced. We are selling the traditional Nvidia products at additional establishments, and we're under no significant pressure to change that at this time. I just want you to know that. And we are doing that consistent with this language, I believe, because we are trying to maximize the existing products and their ability to be profitable and to provide a stable revenue source. To the bill a little bit, I've attached to the back of my testimony, since there's been references made to the lottery revenue stream and what's happened over time. And I just wanted you to be able to see that this is out of the economic forecast that was given last Friday. And it does show that lottery revenues have been strong and growing for many bienniums. What you do see is a major reset that occurred in 09-11, and that the 11-13 biennium revenues are approximately the same as 11-13. So just from a policy consideration standpoint, the drop in revenue from the economy changes and the smoking ban has put us at about 23% below where we were in the 07-09 biennium. So that is capacity that, with the economic recovery that the forecasters are saying will happen over time, that is capacity that the revenues could produce without changing the type of games, the number of retailers, all of that. It's just a capacity that they predict the revenues will rebound as personal income levels increase. It's the way they look at the economic forecast. So if the intent of the bill is for lottery to continue to maintain revenues at the 11-13 level, I'm just making sure that you know that without us doing anything different, the economists are saying that revenue is going to go up. And so it would, by a policy choice, set aside a significant amount of money in that rainy day fund. And if that's your choice, I think their predictions, as long as the economy recovers as predicted, that would be the effect. If the intent of the bill is to set a target, a goal, if you will, that we maintain this level funding, the same as the 11-13 biennium, if it were to apply pressure to the lottery to do something different to just hit that target, we would be in a situation where we would have to consider, if normal course it's going to grow, if we're supposed to hit a target that's flat, we would have to look at what things do we have to do to slow down or reduce or possibly not offer as many games if we're going to blow through that flat funding by virtue of just continuing what we're continuing to do. So being clear in the record as you work this bill, what is the intent? And is it okay if the lottery continue to, through normal course and economic recovery, indirectly benefit from a significant growth in revenue, because that capacity does exist?
And I would hope if the bill goes forward that we would not only be clear in the record but in the bill itself. So appreciate that comment.
Sure.
Thank you.
So briefly just touch on one other aspect toward the back of my testimony, and that's just the second part of our mission that's existed from the beginning has been the phrase commensurate with the public good. And I just want you to know as a committee, as evidenced by the work that the lottery is doing now, the advertising that was spoken to earlier in terms of setting a budget, a limit, and a time, we are taking that aspect of our mission very, very seriously, and there are a number of actions that we do to make that happen. Among those actions is working with groups such as this interim work group that Representative Tomei and Kenner talked to, make sure we're in touch with what their issues and concerns are and that we make appropriate adjustments. There are other bills before this body that will be under consideration that may change some of the policies that the lottery has related to those activities, and I'll be actively participating in those as well. It's a serious thing that we do. We do a number of things, including advertising, as was spoken to earlier, things at our website, the retailer contract that we enforce, the responsible gambling messaging, and a number of other things that I've put in there. Then I will stop short of repeating all of them, but I just want you to know we believe we are making a good faith effort to balance maximizing revenue commensurate with the public good. And an unfortunate side effect of the proposed language is that the phrase doing it commensurate with the public good is deleted. And so, speaking on behalf of the governor, speaking on behalf, I believe, at least of the intentions I have of maintaining stability and that balance, if you will, that we need to have with commensurate with the public good and the commission, we really think that's a very important part of our current mission, and we take it seriously, and we really don't want to have any unintended consequences by having that deleted. With that, I think I will conclude my testimony and answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. The questions, Representative Doherty.
With the lottery games, I mean, we've got video poker and we've got the lotto, and you know, people that buy tickets and scratch offs and that kind of thing. Have there been studies done as to what is the most addictive and what seems to be, which games or games seems to be the cause of more of a cause of gambling addiction?
Yeah,
is it video poker, or is it people that buy the $2 lottery ticket?
Yeah, Chair Reed and Representative Doherty, you know, I wouldn't be able to speak as an expert on that, but I would have to say from everything that I've heard from participating in the work groups and listening to advocates for responsible gambling, it is the speed and the colors and the noise and the flash and the repeat bet capability that a video terminal has. Mm-hmm. The immediate gratification, if you will, for placing a bet and seeing credits or dollars show up, and the ability to be, that entertainment is sometimes three-dimensional, and it has more effects than possible ability for somebody who has addictive behavior to be affected by that.
Thank you. Mr. Gorsuch, did you have anything?
No.
Okay. Representative Parrish.
Yeah.
So I just want to be clear the intent behind the bill. You know, and Representative Tomei and Kinnemers are still here, but this is the capping it is not a target, and I want to be really clear that that's not what this bill is asking to do, is to say, here's your $1.1 billion target of net proceeds, go get it. That's not what we're asking here. We understand that the lottery has a natural evolution of an increase over time, and we're saying, we know we funded in 2011 and 12 with a reserve balance. We know we used the $1.1 million or whatever that number is. We were able to do that. Fund services, maybe not as adequately as people would like them to be, but we funded services. So that's kind of the freeze piece that is in that bill. Anything that 4% rollover of new growth that is going to come, whether you're advertising an arcade or second chance scratch-its or whatever, some of the stuff that you know has the lottery has done to try to be in that pressure point of having to generate revenue. We're wanting that pressure point of, you know, our director to be able to say, well, we don't have to go chase it. It's going to, if it goes and people do it, they do it. But I think it's a really important point to put out that, you know, in that chasing process, 3/4 of the lottery comes from video poker revenue, and we spend, of the lottery's advertising budget, we don't even spend $1 million to, I believe, to do the video poker piece. And the rest of it's, you know, kind of the branding of the lottery, the like I said, great ads on the time and stuff, and then some of the other ads that you see that I don't agree with. But so the video poker is the driver for the lottery. It's not the scratch-its, and I think the gambling proponents or the folks who are here to champion this on the addiction mental health side will tell you it is the video poker is the driver, and it's a large piece of the lottery budget. So what we're asking is we're not pushing that. And if it naturally evolves that people continue to spend at a 4% clip, that's great. If that target doesn't happen, and you know, and again, it's not we're setting that, but if that cap doesn't happen, I think that's good to have come back and have another conversation. But we just don't want to see the lottery. The purpose of that group was to not see the lottery driving that revenue and hawking, you know, video poker to people, and you know, and increasing the number of people who are problem gamblers. And frankly, recognizing the human service cost really depletes the net value of the lottery, because we're having to pay that out in other services from other siloed parts of the budget.
Thank you, Representative Parrish. I think it's clear the intent, both based on your points and the testimony of the sponsors. I also think it's clear that if the bill is going to go forward, it's going to probably require some additional amendments,
sure,
to clarify and
absolutely
so on. So just to be clear about that. Representative Davis.
To that point, Chair, just looking at the text of the bill, because the lottery is going to have to implement this bill based on the text of the law, not the testimony. If the text is clear, they have to follow the text, not our testimony. The text is that the intention is to produce net revenues, net proceeds, in an amount equal to the amount net proceeds produced in the biennium beginning July 1st, 2011. To me, that does set a goal. Clearly, if the word is intention, that's a goal. Director, if you were, as interpreting that, I think we all realize that because of the significant population growth, especially in the Portland area, and natural growth in lottery, would you interpret that as meaning as the lottery would have to take active steps to intentionally reduce lottery usage?
Good Chair Reed and Representative Davis, you know, I took it on its plain meaning of the word, and so I did it without further clarification that this process is going to provide. That would be an issue that we would have some concerns about if we were to set a goal then we would strive very, very hard to hit that goal. And that means potentially doing more or potentially doing less.
Yeah.
Just want to, I think it's just really great that this process is going to add some clarity to what that really means.
Thank you.
Representative Nathan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really think the bill needs to be about a goal about allocating funds, not raising lottery revenue. And I hope that people can think about what the words are. It seems, now it does seem like it's written in a way that says, we have a goal, you got to raise at least this much. Or stop it if you raise too much. And the point that I understood was about how do you allocate the money so you're not tempted to feel like you need to raise more. It really was more about allocation, not raising revenue. But I actually had another question also. I've heard on more than one occasion the director mentioned that lottery funds tend to grow over time and they are expected to grow. I know I have heard in previous presentations in other years that actually lottery funding will level out. There's a certain point, perhaps, according to some economists, that it just isn't going to grow that much more or as rapidly as it has in the past because you've added as many kinds of new ways of gambling as you're going to. We have something on slide 26 in the presentation from the Debt Management Division, a statement that I hope we can get, not today, but some clarification. It says, projected lottery debt capacity has dropped significantly since last year's report due to the sharp reduction in forecast revenues over the next 8 years. So where did this statement come from? And I'm just trying to square that from what we're hearing in the testimony about this bill from a different place. Maybe the two are not mutually exclusive, but it sure is curious to me to have that statement here. I just need to understand more about that.
I appreciate the question. We can ask the director for general comments, and certainly I think Troy can help us follow up with.
I think for the future is fine.
Yeah, general comments on sort of long-term trends that might be.
Yes, thank you, Chair Reed, Representative Nathanson. Without having a chance to talk to Laura Lockwood McCall about that statement before this committee, I'll just basically say what I believe that's telling you. There was a major reset in lottery revenues when the economy went down and the smoking ban kicked in, and it is a long, slow recovery period. And I know that debt capacity that they may have created earlier probably didn't foresee that significant of a drop in lottery revenues, because we have often seen lottery be somewhat insulated from economic downturns. Not this case and this time. And so it did set the debt policy differently, and it is a long recovery period. So that, and I guess it would be remiss not to mention the fact that during the next 4 years, we will be making a replacement capital on replacing the video lottery terminals that are 70 to 80% of our revenue stream because of obsolescence. And so in real dollars, the lottery is self-funding as much of that as it can and trying to minimally impact the state's transfers. But about $35 million a year in the next two biennium we will use to gradually replace those terminals. And so to the extent that $35 million a year affects debt capacity in addition to the slow recovery, I think that's what's behind Laura's statement.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this conversation is reflective of the schizophrenic nature of any conversation regarding sin taxes of any sort. I would just suggest that I don't think this is the proper approach to the problem, because we don't control all the gambling in the state. And thus, all we're doing is herding these people to some other place to gamble, like a tribal casino. And so what I would be more interested in is knowing how much money we're spending to educate kids not to gamble, because the proper approach is to use some of this money to educate those who follow that this is a stupid investment. And so I would just ask you how much of the money that is generated by the machines, which I believe, by the way, I don't know why someone hasn't sued on the basis of fraud given the nature of those machines, because they are a setup, just as you say, to cause you to gamble. And just like any other addiction, you'd think that there'd be some sort of a foundation in there for fraud. But setting that aside, since we're in the state, we don't have to worry as much about those kinds of unfortunate problems. The focus should be on how much we're doing to try to head this off. So my question is, how much are we spending on education for kids to keep them from gambling?
Okay. Chair Reed and Representative Bentz, the legislature has set up a statutory provision where 1% of all the lottery proceeds transferred to the state are dedicated for problem gambling prevention and treatment, which would include education for children. That program is housed in the Office of Health Authority within the former DHS, and so folks from that program would probably know how much was specifically spent toward education, but that's not something.
My question, having been on a school board, I never saw a class on the danger of gambling. Now, maybe it was my fault for not trying to force it through, but I just want to know, are we at your level saying to the folks that are spending the 1%, get into those high schools and train these kids not to gamble?
Chair Reed, actually, I guess I would say that our relationship with how that money is spent is very much at an arm's length. We raise it and transfer it to the state, and then we let the policymakers here at the legislature and beyond direct those activities and how they prioritize. It really isn't something that the lottery operation and implementation has the authority to drive.
Perhaps, Mr. Chair, we could ask whoever that is to come in, and that might help some of us with this bill.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Indeed. Let's try if you could help us follow up on that. Thank you. Representative Parrish, Congressman, the time, so very quickly,
so,
please.
There is a really good document. I think I don't know if you produced it, Larry, or if Harrison produced it, but it's the history of the lottery. And I think there is some preclusion from how they can spend some of those dollars because there was a lawsuit when they tried to allocate money for some police or something. Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon sued the lottery. And in the ruling of that, it very much bound the hands of the lottery for how they spend dollars outside of administration, basic advertising, replacement of machines, etc. So something else to kind of come back and consider. But that's a great document. I don't know who produced it, but probably everybody on this committee should get a copy of it because it's really a great resource.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you very much for testifying. I expect we may be back to this discussion. Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to hear Bill Perry said threw out some trivia question about there's only one person on the panel who has actually removed lottery games. Did you have an answer to that?
He's speaking to me right now.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
That's a setup, Representative Cameron. That completes the list of people who have signed up to testify. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on the bill quickly? I don't see anyone. With that, we appreciate all who testified. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2167. And if there's not anything else to come before the committee today, see you all on Friday.
That's fun.
Thank you. Thank you. That was the